Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question and answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I'd like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much, Sam, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Connect workshop, Living with Metastatic Prostate Cancer, and this is part one of a two-part series, and so today's program is Advances in the Treatment of Metastatic Prostate Cancer. And we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, include a number of prostate cancer organizations as well. And it really is because of that collaboration that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. Now, we have on the call today over 616 participants, and you come from all of the United States. And we also have participants from Australia, Canada, Ireland, Tunisia, United Kingdom, and Venezuela. So you really come from all over the world, and it's really a credit to each of you that you've chosen to spend this next hour with us. Today's program is supported by an educational grant from Janssen Biotech, Inc., and an educational donation provided by Amgen, and I really want to thank them for supporting this program and also for their collaborative partnership in making this program possible and this whole entire series possible. Now, I'd like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials you received from Cancer Care, and those materials is information about our collaborating organizations as a resource to you. There's information about our speakers, and there also is an evaluation form. And I would ask you to take a moment at the end of today's program and complete that evaluation form. And when you think about it, you are the best people to tell us the programs you'd like us to offer. So please tell us what you recommend, what you suggest, and we will try very hard to implement your suggestions. Indeed, this two-part series is one that many of you have asked us to offer, and here it is, and so we do take your recommendations very seriously. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Susan Slovin. Dr. Slovin is attending physician, genitourinary oncology service, Sidney Kimmel Center for Prostate and Urologic Diseases, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, professor of medicine, Department of Medicine, Weill College of Cornell University. And Dr. Slovin is going to present an overview of metastatic prostate cancer, including bone metastases, current standard of care, understanding new treatment approaches, and the role of personalized medicine, and current treatment of bone metastases. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Slovin.
Thank you, Carolyn, and good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. As always, I'm charged with a lot of information being condensed into a very short period of time. A lot of very exciting things going on in the world of prostate cancer, both with localized and metastatic disease. And I guess the most important thing to talk about is the fact that prostate cancer is a very rapidly changing landscape. It's in a state of flux. It's a continuum where we start off with disease that's clinically localized and treated with surgery or radiation to a transition where the cancer returns after primary therapy and can present in different parts of the body, what we now call metastatic. And that most common areas are lymph node and bone. The standards of care still remain, which if you have metastatic disease at the time of your presentation or if you've had primary treatment with surgery or radiation and your disease returns in the form of disease that can be seen in the bone or the lymph node, then the standard of care is what we call hormonal therapy, and that's usually given as an injection either alone or given in concert with what we call an anti-androgen or a testosterone-blocking agent. Another clinical state, if you will, that evolves over time is that somebody is already had their primary therapies, they've had their radiation or their surgery, and despite having developed metastatic disease earlier, they've now failed a lot of different treatments, including hormonal treatment. And these are patients who we often label as castrate metastatic because their cancer is progressing despite the use of hormonal therapy. So I'm going to focus very briefly on what's new and what's exciting. So as I've mentioned before, the standards for patients who have metastatic disease, either at presentation or after having had primary therapy, remains hormonal therapy. And the interesting thing is that while we have at least several new drugs that are out there in the last 5 years that have been approved for metastatic prostate cancer, we've just actually broken the data for a new phase 3 clinical trial whose results were really very outstanding when presented at the American Society of Clinical Oncology. So for patients who are newly diagnosed, that means patients who have never had surgery or radiation, but who have metastatic disease to bone or lymph node, largely bone at the time of presentation, ordinarily we'd recommend hormonal therapy. But there's been a question that's been ongoing for many years among investigators, which is, if you added chemotherapy early on with the hormonal therapy, would that actually be better in terms of overall improvement in quality of life and other measurable parameters compared with using hormonal therapy alone? We know that with hormonal therapy, we expect the patient to go into what we call a radiographic and a biochemical remission, meaning we expect the PSA to go down to less than 0.05. We expect the bone lesions to go away. Well, the addition of a known standard chemotherapy that we often use for patients who have much more advanced disease or have failed hormonal therapy, known as docetaxel or Taxotere, was added to hormonal therapy in a very, very large patient trial. This particular trial was very exciting because it was close to 1,000 men that were equally divided, and they broke down the values to look at men who had 4 metastatic lesions in bone, meaning 4 different sites of disease in bone, versus those men who had less than 4. And they actually found that in those men who had greater than 4 bone lesions, and if treated with docetaxel in addition to their hormonal therapy, they had very, very significant benefits measured by a variety of different parameters compared with the androgen deprivation arm alone. And what's interesting is that among the patients with really high volume disease, so let's say multiple sites of bone disease greater than 4, there was a huge improvement in the overall parameters that we often use to measure how people are doing, pain control, quality of life, and even in terms of extending their quality of life. So this has been something that really hit the papers very, very hard. Everybody's very excited because for the first time for these patients, we know now that we could actually go ahead and use a combination of chemotherapy along with hormonal therapy in newly diagnosed patients with metastatic disease. Now, that being said, does that mean that every man that presents is going to need this kind of therapy? The answer is no. You can look at a variety of different bone scans, and you may have somebody who has such tiny little areas of disease in bone that it would be overkill to give chemo. It would be overkill to impact on their quality of life. However, there are patients who may have 4 very, very large bone lesions or an area where all these lesions coalesce that can be causing them a lot of pain with ambulation, or are just causing a lot of discomfort. And those are the people for whom the benefit would entail. I would also stress to you that one size does not fit all, meaning that it's really up to your doctor that who reviews the data from this clinical trial to determine if, in fact, this is the appropriate treatment for you. Now, we know that in the last several years there have been several other treatments for patients who have metastatic prostate cancer that has progressed despite hormonal therapy. We had talked about the androgen receptor-directed agents, enzalutamide, otherwise known as Xtandi, and abiraterone, otherwise known as Zytiga. These have also been very effective. There also remains standard docetaxel, and proved in the second line is the chemotherapy, cabazitaxel, or otherwise known as Gemtana. Sipuleucel-T continues to be used for patients who have castrate metastatic disease to bone, for example, but who have minimally symptomatic or no symptoms from their cancer. So we've really made tremendous strides in the fact that we have a lot of treatments, many of which were initially approved in the post-chemotherapy, in other words, if you failed docetaxel or if you failed cabazitaxel and are being used. However, these new hormonal therapies, abiraterone and enzalutamide, are now actually being used well before docetaxel, so that the armamentarium is being extended such that people are going on hormonal therapy and being on hormonal therapy a lot longer before they have to go on to chemo. And again, it's not a matter of at a particular stage in your disease you should do A, B, or C. It really depends on, number one, how you're feeling, number two, how your imaging looks, and number three, what your doctor feels is the most appropriate means for your treatment. Now, as always, clinical trials play a very, very important role, or else none of these five new drugs would have been out there. And it is always my impression that if a person is making a transition from failing one treatment to going on to another, the clinical trial will often be a tremendous advantage. I say so because I found that in many cases, a drug that is either being used or repurposed, it's been around, and maybe it's being given with a combination of a biologic or an immune therapy, or a radioisotope, can sometimes work significantly better than the drug itself that's been used and sort of discarded years ago. So it gives you the opportunity of being on cutting-edge science and actually being able to not only contribute to your own welfare, but that of others. Now, the other concern that's out there is always about, if you have metastatic disease, about your bone health. And we still continue to use zoledronic acid, Zometa, as well as denosumab or Xgeva. That still remains a major focus of treatment. But what if you have pain? All right, we're protecting your bones. We know that on occasion you may have pain. Well, radium-223 entered the treatment arena close to a year ago. It was FDA approved because of its extreme benefit to the patient, both symptomatically and through other parameters. Its other name is alpha radin. And the irony is that this was discovered by Marie Curie at the turn of the 1900s. So it's been around for a very long time, but it has a lot of advantages over what we call other bone-seeking pharmaceuticals. So that's around in the armamentarium. It's very important for those people who need it. I do want to touch upon one other point, and that is about personalized medicine. You're going to be hearing the expression of personalized or precision medicine, and this reflects an integrated multidisciplinary approach that involves molecular biology, genetics, bioinformatics, computational biology, structural biology, chemistry, math, physics, computer science, a lot of different approaches, with the fundamental plan to sort of reframe how to classify disease. And so it's changing from a particular cell type to an individual assessment of the cancer cell. And here, too, one size does not fit all. Very often you will hear people talk about how patients, if one patient had a particular treatment, the other patient should have the same. It's not that way anymore. In fact, we try very hard to try to custom tailor what we think is better based on profiling. But not all these profiling tests that you read about on the internet are in any way validated, so this needs to be taken and under advisement. So what ultimately will come from this is learning what the epigenetic drivers or genetic defects are that might propel each individual tumor to grow or metastasize. So a lot of exciting things. We're not all ready for prime time, but believe me when I tell you, everything is in the works right now. So every few months when we do these talks, we will have more data for you. So I hope everybody's encouraged about that. I think I will close at this moment and turn it back to you, Carolyn. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Slovin, always for just an outstanding presentation and overview of all the developments in metastatic prostate cancer. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Michael Zalewski. Dr. Zalewski is Vice Chair, Clinical Research, Chief Brachytherapy Service, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, Professor of Radiation Oncology, Weill Cornell Medical School. And Dr. Zalewski is going to really go over with you the role of radiation oncology, the important role of radiation oncology, clinical trials, and how research makes a difference and contributes to your treatment options, and communicating with your healthcare team. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Zalewski.
Oh, thank you very much, and it is a real pleasure to be here today speaking to you about all these various very important topics, and it's always a pleasure to be part of this distinguished group of panelists that Carolyn puts together so very effectively. Well, my charge is to speak about the role of radiation therapy in the treatment of metastatic prostate or cancer. And we know for many, many years that one of the most common areas where radiation is administered in the setting of metastatic disease is for the treatment of bone metastases. And for many years, we know that radiation therapy directed to the bone is an effective intervention to reduce bone pain related to the spread of disease to the bone from the metastatic deposit. And traditionally, and for so many years, the standard regimen would be 10 sessions of radiation directed to the bone. And this is actually still quite commonly used, where an area is a source of pain. Subsequent tests, very often done, such as a CAT scan, a bone scan, or in some cases an MRI, is performed. These tests show the area of the metastases. And then radiation therapy would be directed to that region. And as I mentioned, a series of 10 treatments often used to reduce the pain associated with the metastatic deposit. And I would say that about, from so many studies, about 60% of the time at least, if not higher, there is a reduction in pain noted about a week, 2 weeks, or sometimes 3 weeks after treatment. And that's, I think, an important point. After an individual gets radiation treatment for a bone metastasis, it's not expected that the pain will disappear immediately. It sometimes takes a week or two, or in some cases longer, to achieve the maximal reduction of pain. Fortunately, with new technologies which are out there, image-guided radiation therapy, or what has been called stereotactic radiosurgery, pinpointed use of radiation directed to the metastatic deposit is sometimes used, especially when there's not a large amount of metastatic disease, but it's found in one, two, or three sites, for instance. Pinpointed radiation can be used. The advantage of using this high-precision radiation would actually be several-fold. Number one, when using pinpointed or stereotactic radiosurgery for those that have limited amounts of metastatic disease, smaller volumes of radiation can be used, which affects less of the normal bone marrow, and that is an advantage for allowing in the future drug therapies to be used without compromising the blood counts. In addition, higher doses can be used, and we've seen over the years that higher doses, especially even to a bone metastasis, has translated into better results, greater likelihood of really putting the disease in the bone in that particular location in a remission. And the greater efficacy of these pinpointed regimens have been used selectively for people, as I mentioned, who don't have a large volume of metastatic deposits, but a few. And we often consider the use of stereotactic radiosurgery in these selected cases. So the point I've made so far is that radiation therapy is a very effective mode of treating bone metastases. A traditional regimen is a series of 10 treatments directed to the bone metastases. And more recently, stereotactic or pinpointed radiotherapy regimens have been used, which have been shown to be quite effective in terms of putting the disease within the bone into a remission, and this is a remission that could be long-term. Another important concept in the delivery of radiation to the bone is to make sure that the bone is stable prior to administering any therapy. Radiation therapy initially causes weakening of the bones, and so we must be very careful if the bone is already significantly weakened or perhaps fractured, that the orthopedic surgeon gets involved in the care as well. This goes back to the treatment of bone metastases is not in the hand of one physician, but it's a multidisciplinary effort which involves the medical oncologist, the radiation oncologist, the urologist, the orthopedic surgeon, as I am now mentioning. And in situations where the bone is weakened or fractured, it's critical that the stability of the bone is assessed and possibly even repaired prior to delivering any kind of radiation. Using that kind of a preventative and a prophylactic approach would reduce the risk of radiation-induced fractures to the bone, which is certainly a possibility if there's a near fracture to begin with prior to the radiation. There is now greater and greater interest in the management of spinal disease. And spinal disease, where the disease is within the vertebral bodies, we know very frequently that with careful MRI imaging, we can determine if the disease is near the spinal canal. And in those situations where it is near that critical organ, the spinal cord, we don't want to wait too long before administering radiation therapy. And in those cases, even with minimal amounts of pain, the medical oncologist is very well aware of the fact that giving or referring patients to radiation to treat early what we call epidural disease, disease near the spinal canal, would indeed in the long run be beneficial for the patient. Because when treating those areas early on before the manifestation of any pain, that could prevent neurologic compromise and any kind of paralysis, which are complications related to disease near the spinal canal. And then finally, radiation treatments are used in the management of disease in the prostate itself, even in the metastatic setting. Sometimes the disease can be very bulky after hormonal therapy, where the disease is resistant to hormonal therapy. And with bulky disease within the prostate, in certain select cases, radiation is administered to the prostate to reduce associated pain or blockage of the urinary channels, which could cause retention of urine. And so it's not infrequent that radiation could be used to palliate and reduce the symptoms of excessive growth of the prostate, even in settings where the disease has metastasized. Finally, it is so important to communicate with your healthcare team, which I mentioned can comprise of a group of physicians, the medical oncologist, the radiation oncologist, the urologist, nursing staff, physical therapy, rehabilitation medicine, the orthopedic surgeon, in fact. All of these people partner together to try to help the individual get through the treatments and deliver the most effective care for the treatment of bone metastases and for any kind of metastatic disease within prostate cancer. And communicating the symptoms, the pain medication regimens, and any new medications that have been given by the primary care physician is always so important to convey to your healthcare team. Thank you very much for your attention today. And thank you, Carolyn.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Zaleski, for a really excellent presentation and really for really addressing the important role of the radiation oncology in the treatment of metastatic prostate cancer. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Natalie Morrell. And Dr. Morrell is Associate Attending Physician, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, Pain and Palliative Care Service, Department of Medicine, Assistant Professor of Medicine, Weill Cornell Medical College. And Dr. Morrell is going to address managing treatment side effects, discomfort, neuropathy, and pain, so all those discomfort side effects that you might be experiencing, and quality of life concerns. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Morrell.
Thank you. Androgen deprivation therapy is the main therapeutic approach. It's also called hormonal therapy. And side effects are usually, most of the treatment-related side effects early on are associated with this therapy. They're usually not seen for the first 3 months, but at about 3 months, people can experience fatigue, anxiety, depressed mood. That usually is the beginning of it. Overall, over time, androgen deficiency resulting from hormonal treatment may cause a cluster of symptoms related to lack of androgens. One of the most common symptoms is hot flashes and night sweats. They're not dangerous, but one of those most annoying symptoms, and it's seen in 60 to 80% of patients. So majority of people on hormonal therapy will experience some degree of hot flashes. Night sweats also can disturb sleep patterns and lead to patients feeling tired and irritable during the day. So it's important that you report side effects to your physician and ask for medication to treat it or for a strategy. There are a few treatment options, and medications can decrease frequency and or intensity of hot flashes by more than 50%. One group that is often used is one medication group that is used often is antidepressant agents. The other group is medications such as gabapentin or pregabalin. They're used to treat a variety of neurological disorders, including epilepsy and neuropathic pain. We call them anti-seizure medications, although they mostly are used for pain and have been shown to be effective in control of hot flashes. Alternative medicine therapies for the treatment of hot flashes in men include acupuncture. An acupuncture after 10 weeks may reduce hot flashes by 70%, and then there is a persistent effect for longer than 3 months that at least half of the patient retain. And active lifestyle and exercises is another strategy to address that. The second, the least annoying side effect of hormonal therapy, but probably the most, one of the most dangerous, is osteoporosis. And Dr. Slovin already described medical approach to treatment of osteoporosis. I wanted to talk about what the patient can do in addition to following the doctor's recommendation and treating the advice and follow through with the recommendations of the doctor in terms of osteoporosis very carefully. The patients also should be aware that osteoporosis can start early as 6 to 9 months after starting hormonal treatment. And if untreated, it can cause bone fractures in 1 out of 5 patients over 5 years. So in addition to what your physician prescribes, you should also focus, you may want to focus on the correcting risk factors, additional risk factors that you may have for osteoporosis, which is low calcium intake. If your vitamin D is low, you have increased risk. Alcohol abuse, so significantly decreasing the alcohol intake may help. And also smoking is an independent factor that may increase the risk of osteoporosis. And the most important intervention for that, in addition to what your doctor will do for you, you can significantly improve your bone health by exercising, which is weight-bearing exercises and aerobic exercises. In addition to osteoporosis, patients with prostate cancer may also develop muscle loss, the same as bone loss. There could be some muscle loss as well during hormonal ablation. It's really important to remember that it doesn't only affect the appearance, it also plays muscle loss may play an important role in physical disability. Muscle loss can increase the risk for falls, especially in elderly patients, and best treatment for muscle loss is exercise it is the same strategy as recommended for prevention and treatment of osteoporosis. The other symptom that often interferes with quality of life of patients is fatigue. It can, again, as I said earlier, it can it could be seen early on. And in one study, 14% of men had severe fatigue already at about 3 months after treatment, after starting hormonal therapy. And again, the counseling and regular exercises appear to be beneficial in helping the fatigue. It's not uncommon that patients complain of anxiety or depressed mood. Depression and anxiety have been recognized to be common in pain in men for prostate cancer. And screening for depression has become part of routine screening before or during treatment for prostate cancer. These symptoms can be addressed, and quality of life can be improved working with the patient and the family. At Memorial Sloan Kettering, we have a special, specially designated psychiatrist who specializes in mood changes commonly seen specifically in men with prostate cancer. The other side effect of hormonal treatment could be increased cholesterol, increased weight, increased risk of diabetes, high blood pressure, and blood clots. And again, this cluster of symptoms, in addition to being seen by your doctor regularly and following your doctor's advice and recommendations, maintaining active lifestyle, focusing on exercises and weight control is what you can do for to improve your quality of life and longevity. To summarize, in addition to reporting your symptoms to your oncologist, who will either recognize either a familiar cluster of symptoms and make recommendations on something that is expected as part of your treatment, or your doctor may want to evaluate your new symptom further, you personally can influence how you feel and how you look while undergoing treatment. There have been more than 10 studies, big studies, that were published over 30 years of prostate cancer treatment, and again, regular exercises resulted in, number one, substantial improvement in muscular strength, number two, decreased risk of osteoporosis, three, it helped fatigue, four, it helped hot flashes, five, it helped depressed mood, six, it improved cardiac fitness and function, seven, it decreased obesity and complications associated with it, and overall, active lifestyle and regular exercises will improve your quality of life and help you offset side effects of treatment. I'm going to talk about pain right now and then just summarize with discussing quality of life again. Pain in prostate cancer can be caused by cancer itself, be related to cancer treatment that will include neuropathy, or be unrelated to either. The incidence of pain rises to 90% as patients enter the advanced phase of their illness, especially when bone metastases occur. Pain is a signal that you need to report to your doctor and nurse, and your doctor will know if this is, again, if this is part of the disease, something that is to be expected, or this is something that needs to be evaluated further. And the doctor and the often the whole team will work on a plan to treat the pain. Well, your oncologist will be the main treating physician for pain. In certain instances, your doctor may suggest you see a pain specialist or involve a multidisciplinary team or a palliative care team. Pain management, basically, there are a couple of strategies. One is direct anti-cancer therapy described by Dr. Slovin and Dr. Zalewski. And two is analgesic medications. Most often people start with something they can get over the counter in the pharmacy, and there, while over the counter painkillers such as Advil, Motrin, and others you can get in your pharmacy without prescription, they can be very helpful. They're also associated with side effects that may accumulate over weeks and months. In particular, your doctor may be monitoring your kidney function, blood pressure, leg swelling, and make sure there is no bleeding from your stomach. You should definitely report all medications you take over the counter to your doctor. The other group is of pain medications we use often opioids. If pain medications are required long-term, we often feel that narcotics or opioid analgesics, they are safer than over-the-counter painkillers if you need to take these medications for many months and years. They're usually prescribed by your oncologist, sometimes by pain specialist. Opioids have been shown many times to improve the quality of life. It's important, of course, to use pain medications as prescribed. It also is important to remember that, unfortunately, barriers to opioid pain management still exist. And if you encounter any difficulty obtaining your medications through your pharmacy, your insurance company, or if you cannot afford what you have been prescribed, you need to talk to your nurse and your doctor and explain and help them develop practical and affordable treatment plan. The other group of agents that specifically may be more helpful in neuropathic pain are medications such as antidepressants, anti-seizure medications, and topical medications. Sometimes physical therapy, occupational therapy, and opioids can be used as well. Neuropathy is a nerve pain that can be less intense than metastatic bone pain, but at times is reported by patients as more consuming and more overwhelming. It can interfere with your function even worse than bone fracture. So if you have any neuropathic pain, again, you need to discuss it with your physician and start treatment. Most of these medications for neuropathic pain are usually started at the lower dose and will need to be titrated up over a couple of weeks for them to work. It's important that you understand there is a timeline for treatment of neuropathy and work with your doctor on this and not abandon the plan if you take medications for 2-3 days and it doesn't work for you. You need to be a little bit patient with that and wait for 2-3 weeks until the doses are titrated to the effective, to the usual effective dose. Overall, it's really important. Some of my patients say, I'm not a quote-unquote pill person. I don't want to take too many painkillers. I'm strong. I can endure the pain. But it's really important that you treat your pain in such a way that you allow yourself to keep active lifestyle as much as possible. Life expectancy from prostate cancer is greatly influenced by the patient's overall health and being physically active. If pain prevents you from staying active, please strongly consider taking stronger pain medications, obviously under the guidance of your doctors, and do your best to continue a healthy and active lifestyle instead of jeopardizing, you know, staying on the couch and not being active, declining but not taking pain medication. It's really not the best approach. And overall quality of life of men with prostate cancer has become an important topic in the literature recently because prostate cancer is one of the most common cancers in the U.S. and also given its long natural history, patients live for many years after diagnosis. And even if at the beginning of the treatment quality of life is low at the baseline, it can improve over time. And it can be helped with medications and active lifestyle. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Morrell. That was excellent and really very comprehensive in addressing many of the treatment side effects that people experience and the discomfort. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, so thank you. And our next speaker is Mr. William Gorin. Mr. Gorin is Director of Clinical Services at Cancer Care, and he will be addressing Cancer Care's free psychosocial services provided by professionally trained oncology social workers, as well as the role of support groups and couple work as well. I'm going to turn this program now over to Mr. Gorin.
Thank you, Carolyn. Being diagnosed with cancer comes with a spectrum of reactions that are multiple, they're complex, and sometimes they're even confusing. They're emotional and they're psychological reactions as well. The interesting thing is that these reactions are very much common responses, and what I mean by that is that they're often shared in terms of the types of reactions, the emotional response to the diagnosis. And what people don't know is who to share these reactions, these responses, these feelings with, or where to go to express and share these feelings with. One of the most common and often heard statements that my colleagues and I hear from those diagnosed with cancer is, "I thought I was the only one having these feelings." Prostate cancer is the primary male-identified cancer where the emotional and the psychological factors of the illness and treatment side effects are justifiably as decisively important as are the clinical factors. And unlike most other cancers, prostate cancer really speaks to the heart of a man's identity as a man and his image, as a man, of a caregiver, of a husband, father. The discussion of cancer on the body, treatment side effects such as loss of libido, sexual virility, impotence, incontinence, these are absolute components to be carefully and clearly reviewed by the medical team and necessitate ongoing exploration with the patient and the loved ones. Fear of the unknown, concerns for the present and future, unexpected and unwanted change in life balance, quality of life, direction of life, which brings on an emotional roller coaster, the concrete and financial considerations, as well as discussions about medical directives, healthcare proxies, and other directives, are all conversations that are a part of this cancer territory. Included in this are other emotional reactions that accompany this, a sense of grief, confusion, fear, anxiety, sadness, anger, shame, and as previously mentioned, anxiety and depression. These are all shared reactions, often very commonly felt by anyone diagnosed with cancer and by the loved one. And as we say, cancer creates stressors in their lives, stressors for the person with cancer and stressors for the caregiver. They're oftentimes just different types of stressors. The balance of these feelings within the context of treatment become the crucial and central theme of the discussions with the oncologist, with the loved ones, and with the patient, as well as with the oncology social worker. And with prostate cancer, there are multifaceted layers and reactions and responses. The variables of treatment decisions and treatment side effects places a man and his partner immediately in the midst of the quality of life issues, rendering, hopefully, the potential for in-depth and heartfelt discussions focused on the makeup of the relationship, especially intimacy and love. It is, I believe, very important, I would say necessary, to speak to a mental health counselor, a professional, no matter what the cancer is or the cancer experience is, and whether that's with a psychiatrist, with a psychologist, or an oncology social worker. But there is another layer, another level of support that is special, effective, and provides incomparable benefits of comfort and support. One of these is the support group, which I'll focus on today, and the other is couples counseling. And as I speak and discuss support groups, this also can be related to couples counseling as well. A support group for the patient or the caregiver gives the individual patient a place to find others going through similar circumstances, a place to share stories and themes about coping with cancer and discuss the decisions, the options, and changes that come with that diagnosis. A support group can provide a safe sanctuary when one can let down his guard and defenses and share all of those complicated and compacted feelings that many men want to share but become concerned about sharing, about burdening or overwhelming their loved ones, their spouse, their wife, their family, or their children. Many men in my experience don't share that inner voice, that inner life. They become quiet, they become increasingly isolated and internalize so much of what they, I believe, wish they could share but don't know how to. So a support group becomes where a man can say these things that he feels he cannot say to his wife, his spouse, his children. It is a place where one can address fears, hear how others are coping, learn strategies, increase knowledge about cancer, and discuss techniques to deal with the ever-increasingly complex healthcare system, such as the Affordable Care Act, which includes new healthcare laws that are applicable to the state that you live in. Support groups can be in person, they can be on the phone, or they can be online. One very major national organization is US2. It's a prostate cancer support organization founded by men with prostate cancer for men with prostate cancer. And there are chapters for US2 has chapters all over the United States with support groups. And I would also would mention cancer care. Cancer care has support groups in person for those in the New York City tri-state area. But for the national audience listening, we also have support groups on the phone, and we have online support groups as well, general support groups. So please go to our website at cancercare.org, www.cancercare.org, to learn about our different groups, our face-to-face groups, our phone groups, and our online support groups, or call our toll-free number 800-813-4673 to speak to an oncology social worker. Thank you, Carolyn.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Gordon. That was really wonderful and very descriptive of the services that we offer at Cancer Care. And now we have time for questions. I'm going to ask Sam to bring all of our speakers on board, and we're going to ask some questions. If we don't get to your question, Please call Cancer Care at 1-800-813-HOPE, and our social workers are here to answer your questions. But we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. And remember, we are here for all of you for the long haul. So if you don't get to ask a question, think of a question, in the next couple of days or next week, next month, always contact us. And also call us for the help and services that you can access as well. So Sam, can you explain to the audience how to queue up for questions?
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. If you'd like to ask a question, please press star, then the number one key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking on the Ask a Question button.
We have a question from one of our online participants, and it's actually for Dr. Zalewski. Can radioactivity after radiation therapy hurt my partner? Dr. Zalewski, could you address that? I know that's a question that people are always asking, and could you address that?
Sure, it's an excellent question, and when the kind of radiation we were talking about today was the use of external beam radiation, which generally comes from a linear accelerator, and it's the source of radiation is external. So there's nothing internally placed in an individual. Therefore, there are absolutely no risk, harm to any spouse, family member from the treatment itself. In fact, immediately after the treatment, if we would put a Geiger counter, which measures radioactivity, right on the area that got the radiation, there wouldn't be any detectable radiation. So the answer is, Carolyn, it is completely safe and no harm to anybody, family members, or any contacts.
Excellent, thank you. And Mr. Gordon, could you comment on that, too, as an issue that comes up in our support groups? And
yes, thank you, Carolyn. I think that these concerns are within the realm of a lot of concerns that the person, a man with prostate cancer, has about the impact on the quality of the relationship, the sexual life, the sexual quality of life that the couple has. And I think it's something that should and could be addressed within the context of a support group or within the context of couples therapy, which would allow the couples to share their concerns and their issues and their fears and their confusion about both prostate cancer and the treatment used in prostate cancer. So I agree. I think that's an excellent question.
Excellent. Thank you. Our next question is really to hear more about what brachytherapy is and how it more clarification about brachytherapy. Dr. Zalewski?
Sure. Brachytherapy, actually the word brachy is a Greek word which means close by. That is radiation treatments delivered in close contact to the tumor. So brachytherapy is a very popular form of treatment in the non-metastatic setting. That is when an individual first is diagnosed with prostate cancer and the cancer is limited to the prostate itself. Of the various options that are available to treat the cancer in this early setting, it could be surgery, it could be external beam radiation, or brachytherapy, which is commonly also called the seed implants. And that's where the radioactive material is placed very precisely within the gland, within the prostate gland, and with confined cancers that has been associated with a high success rate, fortunately. In the metastatic setting, we don't really use brachytherapy, but the closest is what Dr. Slovin was talking about, the radium-223, or Xofigo, and this is a radiopharmaceutical that's injected into the vein, which is a bone seeker, and that is directed to the areas that are active in terms of metastases to the bone, and shown in a large trial to be associated with better results in terms of less often the disease recurring or new deposits coming up in the bone less often when this radiopharmaceutical has been used. So brachytherapy, classically used for the earlier stages of disease, not really for the metastatic states.
And this is another question for you, Dr. Zalewski, from one of our online participants regarding the number, Dr. Zalewski, number of sessions when stereotactic radiation is used to treat bone metastases. If you could address that in a general way.
Sure. That's a very good question, and there are actually studies that we are in the midst of performing to try to find out the optimal number of sessions or optimal dosing for stereotactic radiosurgery. Sometimes these treatments are given in 5 sessions, sometimes in 3 sessions, and we are exploring whether one very large dose delivered in 1 session may be even more effective in the treatment of disease. So it's a very good question, but it's an ongoing area in clinical research right now.
And you can say a little bit about the clinical research itself and how that is conducted so people have a clearer understanding of that, Dr. Zalewski.
Sure, Carolyn. Clinical research is generally in the setting of metastatic disease, as Dr. Slovin had explained, exploring various new and innovative drug regimens. And many of these studies have compared standard regimens to these more novel regimens. In radiation therapy, as I just explained, we often compare standard radiation dosing regimens to more novel regimens, or the utilization of radiation with novel drug therapies as well to enhance the efficacy of the radiation. And of course, these research initiatives and opportunities are really excellent avenues for the patient to explore, because one can take advantage of these novel therapeutics, these novel interventions, and benefit not only for others, but even for the individual himself. And in so many areas in metastatic prostate cancer, there's so much that we don't know about, and there are so many people who have benefited from this clinical research, which, of course, is done in the setting of a trial where people enroll on it, they receive their appropriate and sign the appropriate consent forms. And these kinds of trials are done in very careful and meticulous fashions. And in the long run, I believe, as we all do, that the patient will benefit a great deal by exploring these new kinds of regimens. Maybe Dr. Slovin would want to comment.
There is another question from one of our online participants about can radiation cause secondary problems such as urinary incontinence or indoor bladder cancer down the road? Dr. Zlusky, could you address that as well?
Sure. Of course, it depends where you're aiming the radiation. If the radiation is aimed near the bladder region, near the urethra, the channel where the urine goes through, then down the road, scarring can develop, which could lead to either blockage or, in some cases, damage to the sphincters could lead to urinary incontinence. Fortunately, the likelihoods of those complications happening have been substantially reduced with the availability of sophisticated radiation technologies, which allow us to target the radiation more effectively and allow us to reduce the dose to the normal tissues that are nearby the areas we are targeting. So, yes, it's important for the individual to discuss with his doctor the risks of long-term side effects, because that's very important, obviously, in coming to any decision about the appropriate therapy. And once again, and the good news is that with better technologies, the risks are there, but they're substantially reduced nowadays.
Thank you. Well, I would like to thank all of our speakers. This has been an extraordinary call, a lot of information that you've all here to absorb and to learn about. I appreciate your being on the call. I'd like to thank our speakers. You've been an extraordinary team. I want to also thank all of you who've been listening and who've posted such wonderful questions as well. And I want to remind you that this is a one-hour education program and that in planning a program like this, we recognize that you all have many needs that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour. And with that in mind, I would like to remind all of you of all the services that you can access from Cancer Care. And we also have a part two to this, conference call. There'll be a part two for caregivers coping with a loved one's metastatic prostate cancer on June 27th. So many of you have signed up for that, but if you haven't, you know, please do actually. And Cancer Care offers a host of services. We have many oncology social workers here on staff, and they provide a number of services from individual counseling, a chance to talk with a social worker here, our support groups, both on the telephone and online. We also offer practical and financial assistance, as well as, of course, many of these workshops, and we have many publications and fact sheets that are also helpful to you, and a very robust website with lots of information. So most importantly, I would not want anyone to think that you're alone in coping with metastatic prostate cancer or with cancer. I want you to know that you're now part of the cancer care community, and we're here to help you. And we're simply a telephone call away, or you can visit us on our website as well. Again, our telephone number is 1-800-813-HOPE, and please do contact us with any questions or concerns you may have, and we will be, I'm sure, in touch with you over the next programs that we're offering. Again, thank you so much, and I wish you all a very fine day.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This does conclude today's workshop. You may disconnect. Everyone, have a wonderful day.